headlines this hour. Muslim pilgrims converge in large numbers in the Iraqi city of Karbala to mark Arba'in, the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein. Greece signs a deal with France to buy three new frigates as Paris seeks to bounce back from the loss of a big submarine contract with Australia. Also this hour, Germany's social democrats, who narrowly won Sunday's national election, say they hope to open talks later this week about forming a three-way government. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. It's good to have you with us. Crowds of Muslim pilgrims are in the Iraqi holy city of Karbala to commemorate the Day of Arba'in. The annual occasion is one of the world's biggest religious gatherings. It marks the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. Pilgrims, most of them Iraqis, have walked to Karbala, where Imam Hussein is buried. Security is beefed up in and around the city. Prior to the pandemic, the event drew millions each year, but now the Iraqi government has restricted the number of foreign pilgrims to several 10,000. Imam Hussein and dozens of his companions were martyred during the Battle of Karbala with the tyrant of their time over 13 centuries ago. They were killed on the day of Ashura.
Muslims marked Arba'in, the 40th day that followed the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, the third Shia Imam and his 72 strong companions in the Battle of Karbala in what is now southern Iraq in 680 AD. Each year, millions of Muslim mourners set out on a symbolic 80-kilometer-long walk that begins from the holy city of Najaf in Iraq, where Imam Hussein's father Imam Ali's shrine is located, to the holy city of Karbala that houses Imam Hussein's shrine. But this year, due to COVID-19 pandemic, Iraq has imposed restrictions on the number of pilgrims. According to Iranian officials, nearly 60,000 Iranian pilgrims have traveled to Iraq to partake in the huge annual Arba'in procession. The Arba'in march is of great significance for Muslims. In Iran, those who cannot make it to Karbala take part in a symbolic march from Tehran to the town of Ray towards the holy shrine of Hazrat Abdulazim Hassani.
Arba'in march is one of the largest religious gatherings in the world, which manifests the extent of the age-old love for Imam Hussein and his ideology of resistance against injustice. This year, although the COVID-19 pandemic has either cancelled or restricted most of the mourning processions, our love for Imam Hussein runs deep in our hearts and will never fade away.
The love for Imam Hussein runs in our family. My family and I always take part in such religious ceremonies to remember Imam Hussein, because with his sacrifice, he saved the true Islam. Still, after 14 centuries, we honor him as a savior of our religion, and he's the best role model for me and my children.
Over the past decade, the Iranian and Iraqi people have begun participating in what came to be known as the Great Walk of Arba'in, a procession during which millions of Iranian and Iraqi Shias travel on foot to the shrine city of Karbala, south of Iraq, to renew allegiance with the ideals and teachings of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. The Battle of Karbala featured an unjust fight between Imam Hussein and his army and the hugely outnumbered army of the Umayyad Caliph of the time, Yazid.
The Day of Arba'in is a day on which the family members of Imam Hussein return to the plain of Karbala to properly bid farewell to their fallen heroes and finally grieve for their loved ones. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Islamic researcher Muhammad Nasser Biriya says the first Arba'in held after Imam Hussein's martyrdom set in motion a resistance movement that inspired many freedom fighters throughout history.
A movement started, and as dominoes, the movements after movements started, and this is continued today, until today. And this resistance, if you see the great leaders of the movements for freedom and against the injustice in the world, most of them, they have taken their lessons from this resistance. and the people of Palestine and the people of Syria and the people in all the world, this is the real lesson that they can take from Arba'in, and that's why Arba'in is so important, that you believe that the resistance will eventually be successful and you will reach the Arba'in. You will reach the point that not only the enemy is defeated, but also the message is spread, and you have guaranteed the movement to continue. This is the message of Arba'in.
Sam Mehdi Torabi is the director of the Rasalat Strategic Studies Institute. He says that some Western media downplay the Arba'in event, making it all the more necessary for Muslims to have their own global media network.
I think this is something we need to just kind of, you know, realize and understand, that there's no such thing as objective media. There's no such thing as, for example, the Western media covering the world in a fair way and covering news stories that go against the narrations. I mean, I think we should just get beyond this. I mean, it's getting tired. You know, I'm getting tired of talking about this the whole time. As long as we don't have our own media, you know, global media network, this is what it is. If we don't have satellites, if we don't have, you know, the technology, and if we don't have the software and the production of capabilities to have a global media, this is what it's going to be. And it's always been the case. And we saw from the very first day, you know, at the time of the events in Karbala itself. I mean, if it wasn't for Zainab, if it wasn't for Imam Sajjad, we would have never known about what happened. So it is the nature and the essence of those who are oppressors to not cover the news stories that are to their disadvantage, and to propagandize whatever it is, whether it's their own actions or whether it's the actions of the people that they are trying to oppress, or the forces that are resisting them.
Yemen's armed forces have taken control of strategic areas located west of Al-Juba district in the southern part of Marib province. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, reports.
Following fierce clashes with the Saudi-led coalition's forces in the southern front of Marib province, Yemeni forces have taken control of Hurra and Najd regions and the strategic Umrah Beach region located west of Al-Juba district.
Marib is of a strategic importance because it has oil and gas, and this region supplies oil to all of Yemen. It is also Yemeni land, and the Yemeni army must liberate it from foreign powers that have wreaked havoc in the country. For years, this was a base for the Saudi-led coalition, from which they launched many operations to destroy Yemen. So the Yemeni army is determined to liberate all of Yemen's soil.
The advances, military experts said, will put more pressure on the Saudi-backed forces inside the city, as the Al-Juba district is close to the city and one of the last lines of defense for the Saudi-backed forces.
The recent victories of the Yemeni army come during the last phase of the Battle of Marib, as the Al-Juba area is near the city of Marib and is considered one of a few strategic districts of Marib that remains under the control of the Saudi forces. After the liberation of Al-Juba, all the enemy defenses that have been protecting the mercenaries of the Saudi-led coalition for many years will fall. Victory is very near, thanks to great sacrifices made by the Yemeni army and support offered by local tribes.
For months now, the Yemeni army has been intensifying its military operations to liberate the oil-rich province of Marib. Meanwhile, the Yemeni troops continue to advance toward the camp of Saudi-backed forces in the region of Khashina, which was recently hit by two ballistic missiles.
Marib is witnessing remarkable advances by Yemen's armed forces backed by local tribes who are determined to liberate their soil from foreign powers. People here say the Saudi-backed forces should leave the country before they get expelled by the Yemeni army. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
2 months have passed since Nigeria's top Muslim cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki was released from jail after 6 years. We're prepared a report that explains why the prominent cleric was imprisoned. We'll also talk to the Sheikh on Wednesday. Marzia Hashemi will do the interview on 1630 GMT.
Prominent cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki is the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria known as the IMN. the top Muslim cleric and his supporters have been subject to a crackdown by Nigerian authorities over the past years. The most brutal attack took place in December 2015 in the northern city of Zaria, Kaduna State. The army opened fire on Zakzaki's supporters, killing hundreds, including three of his sons. The military accused the sheikh's supporters of having tried to stop the passing convoy of the army chief to assassinate him. The IMN vehemently denied that accusation. During the crackdown, Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife suffered gunfire wounds. They were taken into custody under the pretext of protecting them from violence in Zaria. But they were later charged with culpable homicide, unlawful assembly, and disruption of public peace, among other things. A year later, the Abuja High Court ordered their release, but the Nigerian government defied the order. Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife remained in prison until July 28th this year, when they were released after a Kaduna High Court dismissed all charges against them. The IMN welcomed the ruling, saying it is a victory of perseverance in the face of extreme persecution. Kaduna state officials later acknowledged in a report that the military had acted disproportionately in connection with Sheikh Zakzaki and the Zaria massacre, and that the soldiers involved should be punished. No one has so far been prosecuted over the incident.
An explosion has hit a residential building in the Swedish city of Gothenburg, sending at least 20 people to the hospital. Some reports have put the number 25, including three women, injured seriously. The explosion hit the building early on Tuesday. Gothenburg's emergency services says that the teams are still working to put out fires in the building. They say several apartments and stairwells have been affected. Emergency services say that several hundred people have already been evacuated. The rest are being evacuated also. Swedish police say that an investigation is underway to find the cause of the blast. France says it has signed a defense deal with Greece to sell it three frigates.
It allows for the deepening of Franco-Hellenic cooperation on strategic issues in the field of foreign policy, in military matters, as well as in the defense industry, which has been concretely translated into the Greek decision to acquire Rafale fighter aircraft. And today, by your announcement, Mr. Prime Minister, of your decision to provide Greece with three Bellerophon frigates that will be built in France, in Lorient, as a sign of confidence and a demonstration of the quality of our relationship.
The deal worth more than $3.5 billion was signed at the Elysee Palace. Macron hailed the agreement as a sign of confidence in France's defense industry against competition from the U.S. He said the deal marks what he called an audacious first step towards European strategic autonomy. The Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis said that the agreement will not affect the ongoing defense cooperation talks with the U.S. France has recently got into a dispute with the U.S., U.K., and Australia after Canberra scrapped a deal with Paris to build conventional submarines. Australia would instead build nuclear-powered submarines with U.S. and British technology. Germany's Social Democrats, who narrowly won Sunday's national election, say that they want to open talks on forming a coalition government. The Social Democrats narrowly won the vote ahead of Chancellor Angela Merkel's Conservatives. Now they say they hope to talk to the Greens and the Free Democrats later this week about forming a three-way government. That comes as smaller parties, the Greens and the Liberal FDP, have said that they would first talk to each other before negotiations with either the Social Democrats or the Conservatives. The Greens and the FDP are themselves far apart on many issues. Their plan for talks has been welcomed by the Social Democrats. The Sunday election saw Chancellor Angela Merkel leave power after 16 years. British authorities have put the military on standby to help deal with the ongoing fuel crisis, as fear over tanker driver shortages has led to panic buying there. In a statement, the Energy Ministry's Department for Business said that a limited number of military tanker drivers are on a state of readiness and will be deployed if necessary to further stabilize fuel supply chain. This as shortage of tanker drivers has left many of the country's pumps dry. The shortage is due to new Brexit visa regulations as well as the COVID backlog. The U.S. federal government is facing a partial shutdown as the Senate has failed to pass an emergency spending bill. The $3.5 trillion bill received 50 no votes after Republicans refused to increase the limit on federal debt. It needed at least 60 votes to be approved in the 100-seat Senate. Democrats say that they will try again before Thursday's deadline to push the measure ahead. That is when current funding to keep the U.S. government operating expires. Shutdown could lead to unpaid leaves for hundreds of thousands of federal employees and a halt to many government functions. Thousands of healthcare workers are expected to be fired in the U.S. state of New York for not complying with the COVID-19 vaccine mandate, taking effect on Monday. New York hospitals are postponing non-necessary surgeries to boost their vaccination rates. However, health centers in areas with lower vaccinations are facing a shortage of staff. The state issued an order last month mandating that all healthcare workers receive at least one dose of the vaccine by September 27th. The push came amid a rise in the number of daily infections and fatalities in the U.S. Authorities blame the hike on the outbreak of the highly infectious Delta variant of the coronavirus. North Korea's ambassador to the U.N. has called on the U.S. to give up its hostile stance toward his country. Kim Sung added that no one could deny his country's right to self-defense and weapons tests. He made the remarks on the last day of the U.N. General Assembly, shortly after the South Korean military said that the North had fired an unidentified projectile into its eastern waters. Kim demanded that the U.S. permanently stop its joint military drills with South Korea. Pyongyang has long accused Washington and Seoul of pursuing a hostile policy. Talks aimed at dismantling the North's nuclear and ballistic missile programs, in return for U.S. sanctions relief, collapsed in 2019. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
February 27th, 2021. Although Lady Zainab had lost her son, a brother and relatives, she was supportive and a companion until the last moments. But the culmination of Zainab's role is after the incident, when nothing was left of the relationship and she had the first role. In Shia literature, it is often said that blood prevails over the sword in the event of Karbala. The cause of this victory was Lady Zainab. If it wasn't for Lady Zainab, peace be upon her, the blood in Karbala would have been forgotten. On the day of Ashura, a military confrontation ended with the apparent defeat of the forces of truth. But what turned this apparent military defeat into a definite permanent victory was Lady Zainab's role. The role played by Lady Zainab, peace be upon her, was the continuation of the movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi as-salam. And if it were not for her, that uprising would have been lost in the history. This incident showed that women are not on the margins of history and subordinate to men. The Shia woman is at the center of important historical events. relying on her faith and religion. A woman act in a way to humiliate an enemy at the center of his power, while he has ostensibly won the military campaign and has crushed his opponent and leaned on the throne of victory. She put the eternal stigma on his forehead and changed his victory into defeat. This is what Lady Zainab, peace be upon her, has done. Lady Zainab, peace be upon her, showed that woman's hijab and decency can be turned into an eternal honor. Isn't not this example a perfect proof that women in Islam are in the context of politics and society, and that the monotheistic traditions and religion do not want women to be inferior, but it places them at the top of the human peaks?
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
In recent decades, the United States has increasingly used sanctions as an instrument of foreign policy. There are different types of sanctions: economic or financial restrictions, trade prohibitions, and blocking or seizing assets of individuals, organizations, and countries. Now, a coalition of North American human rights organizations, named the Sanctions Kill Coalition, has released a report on the impacts of the U.S. sanctions on other countries and their people. Whether direct or indirect, most of the U.S. sanctions are not authorized by the United Nations Security Council, and many of them are imposed unilaterally by Washington. In fact, more than two-thirds of the world's countries officially condemn U.S. sanctions as a blatant violation of international law and the U.N. Charter. The report has also revealed a bitter reality that Western media rarely or never talk about. One finding is that U.S. sanctions are hurting the most vulnerable and driving middle-class citizens into poverty. Also, they have resulted in thousands of deaths and humanitarian exemptions. For instance, U.S. sanctions on the Syrian Central Bank have collapsed the country's currency, sending millions of civilians into grinding poverty. Also, waiving sanctions by the U.S. undermine countries' capacity to respond to the coronavirus pandemic, resulting in loss of lives. The inhumane sanctions cause difficulty for countries like Iran to obtain medical supplies, sanitation equipment, and other necessary goods to slow the virus spread. Therefore, the U.S. contributed to many unnecessary deaths in Iran.
So we've actually known for 100 years, at least a century, what the impact is. The impact is primarily felt by the civilian population, and it is devastating.
The report also says many U.S. sanctions are based on false claims of an emergency and a threat to national security. The The 76th annual session of the United Nations General Assembly kicked off in New York. World leaders discussed a myriad of topics of global concern, including rejecting inhumane sanctions. During his speech at the United Nations General Assembly, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro called for the lifting of sanctions imposed by the United States and the European Union on his country.
We ratify our request. Our demand to the United States and the European Union governments lift all the criminal sanctions against the Venezuelan economy, against the Venezuelan society. We say it with the reason and morality that we have, and we say it on behalf of 30 million Venezuelans.
Maduro denounced what he called permanent systematic aggression waged against Venezuela through these restrictions and called for the establishment of a new world free of colonialism and imperialism. Also, Cuban President Díaz-Canel lashed out at the U.S. administration of Joe Biden for intensifying, quote, the cruelest economic blockade ever imposed against any nation.
The U.S. government has not for 1 minute ceased its attacks on Cuba. But at this crucial and challenging moment for all nations, its aggressiveness exceeds all limits. The cruelest and most prolonged economic, commercial, and financial blockade ever applied against any nation has been opportunistically and criminally intensified in the midst of the pandemic.
Addressing the UN General Assembly, the Cuban president said, "The U.S. is extorting sovereign states to act against countries it identifies as adversaries." He said the U.S. presses its allies to build coalitions to overthrow legitimate governments. Western media has failed, or maybe wanted to fail, to inform the public about the consequences and global condemnation of U.S. sanctions. Most U.S. citizens are unaware of the severe harm being done to millions of residents of countries such as Venezuela, Cuba, Syria, and Iran.
It's a primary foreign policy tool that the U.S. government uses in order to weaken and decimate countries that it has disputes with. It should be considered a crime against humanity. The kind of sanctions against a country, against a whole people or a whole nation, should be considered a crime against humanity because the effects are horrible.
Exacerbating the suffering of civilians in different countries during a severe health crisis such as the coronavirus pandemic is morally corrupt and a clear disregard for basic human rights. This is what U.S. sanctions have done. The U.S. may be quick to deny this, but deep down it wants sanctions to provoke the populations to rise against the government in the hopes of regime change in the respective countries, something it has for the most part failed to achieve.
After days of controversy, the U.S. House of Representatives has passed a $1 billion bill to fund Israel's so-called Iron Dome missile system. American lawmakers approved the bill in a 420-9 vote on Thursday. The push had appeared in a bill on Tuesday aimed at providing emergency funding to the U.S. government to avoid a shutdown, but was later removed without explanation. The removal was attributed to opposition from a small group of Democrats who demand the U.S. support for Israel be based on the regime's human rights record. The exclusion of the provision, however, drew strong reactions from Republicans and pro-Israeli Democrats, with Republican Senator Lindsey Graham calling the move despicable.
The progressive movement in Congress consists of maybe, less than 10% of the Congress. So they have very little power. And furthermore, the progressives in Congress don't often use their power. They're intimidated a lot of times into going along with the rest of it. So we can't expect very much from the progressives.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett thanked both parties in the House for their support, adding that those who tried to challenge the U.S. support for Israel got a resounding response. The bill is now heading to the Senate, where it's highly likely to be approved, as American politicians from both political camps have traditionally backed Israel. It's also expected to be signed into law by President Joe Biden, who has already signaled support for the additional aid. pro-Israel-American lawmakers have been pushing for additional funds to Israel to replenish the regime's missile system since the most recent war on Gaza ended in a ceasefire earlier this year. The truce stopped the 11-day conflict in May, the most intense fighting between Palestinian resistance groups and Israel in years. Palestinians have hailed their victory in the battle, citing the show of force to the Israeli regime by launching over 4,000 rockets and scores of drones to combat the enemy. The sheer scale of the attacks overwhelmed Israel's so-called Iron Dome anti-missile system. The war killed over 250 Palestinians, including 66 children in Gaza and 12 people in Israel. That's a significant number, considering the regime's heavy expenditure on anti-missile systems, while the resistance in the impoverished and besieged Gaza Strip has no means of shooting down Israel's missiles.
From the point of view of justice, there's no reason not for Palestinians not to have an Iron Dome system. But obviously, that's not what Israel wants at all. Israel wants to be able to hit Palestinians, to cause misery and destruction and death to Palestinians whenever they feel like it.
The move by Washington to increase aid to Israel comes despite calls by some U.S. politicians and activists to cut fundings to pressure the regime into respecting Palestinians' rights. With all that said, the reversal of the move to include the additional aid to Israel in the U.S. government's spending budget suggests that Washington's unwavering support for the regime is beginning to falter, as no U.S. lawmaker would hesitate to approve more funding for Israel a few years ago.
Thousands of Yemenis have taken to the streets to mark the 7th anniversary of the September 21 revolution against the Saudi-backed regime in Sana'a. Participants in the rally chanted slogans against foreign aggression while carrying the country's tricolor flag and pictures of top resistance leaders. They also denounced the criminal complicity of Western powers and the Israeli regime in the Saudi-backed aggression and war-ravaged Yemen. The demonstrators vowed to uphold their revolutionary ideals and not surrender to the foreign powers. Said the popular revolution had thwarted the conspiracy to divide Yemen through resistance to foreign aggression and hegemony.
Yemeni people are working hard to liberate themselves from the tutelage and occupation. It is known to the world that the occupation does not last, and no matter how long it remains, it will eventually depart.
In 2014, the people of Yemen led a popular uprising against the Saudi-backed, unpopular regime of Abdel Mansur Hadi. As protests gripped the country, the Ansarullah resistance movement on September 21 took control of the capital Sana'a, following a rapid advance south from their northern stronghold of Sada'a. The massively popular protests were against an incompetent and corrupt regime in Sana'a, backed by Riyadh and directed by the U.S. In a bid to crush the resistance and reinstall the Hadi regime, a Saudi-led coalition launched a ferocious bombing campaign on the neighboring Arab country barely 6 months later.
I think at this present time, the Saudis are willing to keep this thing going. Even if they can't win, they'll keep it going so as to not be pointed at and said they lost. How long they can do this is, I don't know, but I think that's our present situation.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement says the U.S. was in charge of administering his country's internal affairs prior to the popular revolution against former Yemeni President Abdel Mansur Hadi, better known as the September 21 revolution. He highlighted that Washington used to conduct Yemen's affairs before the September 21 revolution, and the U.S. embassy in Sana'a had the upper hand over the presidential office. The Ansarullah leader went on to say that the U.S. used al-Qaeda terrorists to create division within Yemen and to advance his hegemonic agenda, stressing that Washington also sought to influence Yemen's educational system in favor of the Israeli regime.
The Saudis and the UAE are influenced by the U.S., as is the U.S. influenced by them. They are dependent often on U.S. weapons, of which they are major purchasers, because, and that makes us dependent on them. But they are not controlled by Washington.
He added that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are just pawns in the hands of the U.S. and are cows being milked by Washington to serve the Tel Aviv regime's interests. Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S. and regional allies, launched the war in Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing Hadi's government back to power and crushing Ansarullah.
I don't think that the Saudis can win under present circumstances. And I think the support, whatever they got out of Trump, is probably less now, relatively speaking, under Biden. But there's this other factor, and the factor is that the Saudi government and the head of the Saudi government doesn't want to lose face. Now, you and I might be able to accept losing face under certain circumstances, but they don't believe that they ever want to lose face.
The war has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions more. It has also destroyed Yemen's infrastructure and spread famine and infectious diseases. The Yemeni armed forces and allied popular committees, however, have grown steadily in strength against the Saudi-led invaders, leaving Riyadh and its allies bogged down in the country. Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, has addressed the 76th session of the United Nations General Assembly by a video conference. It was his first address to the main policy-making organ of the world body since taking office last month. During his speech, Raisi said the U.S. efforts to impose hegemony on other countries have, quote, failed miserably, and that Washington's hegemonic system lacks credibility. Raisi said Washington is using sanctions as a new way of war against other nations, stressing that the U.S. sanctions against the Islamic Republic during the coronavirus pandemic are crimes against humanity. This year, two scenes made history. One was on January 6, when U.S. Congress was attacked by the people, and two, when the people of Afghanistan were dropped down from the U.S. planes in August, from the capital to Kabul. One clear message was sent to the world: U.S.'s hegemonic systems has no credibility, whether inside or outside the country. He described sanctions as the U.S.'s new way of war with the world countries.
Raisi represents the anti-imperialist current of the Iranian population that is fed up with sanctions. For years, the U.S. has been imposing brutal sanctions that have devastated Iran's economy, killed families, working class families of Iran who are unable to access medicine, infrastructure, because of sanctions. And the goal all along with the U.S. was to impose sanctions, blame it on the policies of the Iranian government, make it seem like the U.S. needs to step in with humanitarian aid and overthrow the democratic government in Iran.
Ebrahim Raisi said sanctions against the Iranian nation started not with Iran's nuclear program, stressing that they predate the Islamic Revolution and go back to the year 1951, when oil nationalization went underway in Iran. The Iranian president also said, despite the fact that the Islamic Republic was keen from the outset to purchase and import COVID-19 vaccines from reliable international sources, it faced inhumane medical sanctions. He also described sanctions on medicine at the time of the COVID-19 pandemic as crimes against humanity.
But sanctions have been extremely crippling on all fronts, and the irony here is that the U.S. claims to be imposing sanctions for the purpose of humanitarianism, for human rights, when in reality, sanctions violate those very same human rights that they claim to be defending. It worsens people's conditions. It puts people further into poverty.
The Iranian president said that Tehran has been adhering to its nuclear commitments under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, while Washington violated the 2015 landmark accord, stressing that the U.S. so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran has failed. The Iranian president underlined that 15 reports released by the International Atomic Energy Agency have attested to the adherence of Iran to its commitments. However, the U.S. has not yet discharged its obligation, which is lifting sanctions. We want nothing more than what is rightfully ours. We demand the implementation of international rules. All parties must stay true to the nuclear deal and the UN resolution in practice.
The goal and intent of those imperialists in Washington, D.C., who wanted to impose sanctions, impose hegemony, their goal was to worsen the conditions in these countries to a point where people would be begging for U.S. interference, to blame that on the policies of those governments. This has actually had the opposite force, where the people of Iran know, the people of Venezuela know, the people of Cuba, Nicaragua, Peru, they know that it's not the policies of their governments that are creating crisis, but it's U.S. sanctions, U.S. hegemony, U.S. imperialism that is at the root of all of these problems.
Raisi said that Iran has no trust in U.S. promises and wants all anti-Tehran sanctions to be removed at once, noting that the Islamic Republic considers the nuclear talks useful only when their ultimate outcome is the lifting of all unilateral sanctions. The U.S. under former President Donald Trump left the JCPOA in 2018 and returned the sanctions that had been lifted against Tehran as part of the agreement. During his address at the UN General Assembly, Biden voiced his intention to rejoin the landmark nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, in full if Tehran does the same. He said the U.S. was working with China, France, Russia, Britain, and Germany to engage Iran diplomatically and to seek a return to the JCPOA. But the U.S. has yet to take palpable measures to prove its commitment to the JCPOA since its 2018 withdrawal from the accord in spite of international criticism.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is the teacher. We will tell you the story of the martyrs of the sacred defense of Iran.
خدا انشالله رحمت کنه شهید عزیزمون مرحوم شهید اورنسی رو، همونطور که عرض کردیم استاد حسین اورنسی رو.
May Allah bless the soul of شهید عبدالحسین برانسی.
شهداؤنا تاریخنا، شهداؤنا کل امجادنا.
Our martyrs are the makers of our history. Our martyrs are our glory. Our martyrs are the spoken words of
the Prophet of Guidance, peace be upon him, and his holy progeny said, "The life of the world is like dipping your finger in the sea and bringing it out."
Today's story, the life and character of Shahid Abdul Hussein Boronsi. Dear listeners, one of the great martyrs of the Iranian sacred defense is Shahid Abdul Hussein Boronsi, who due to his agility and skillfulness in combat was known as Bruce Lee by the Iraqis. Shahid Boronsi was a man who, since the time he was a child until the time of his death, treaded the path of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam and wanted nothing but their satisfaction. Shahid Boronsi was born in 1942 in a village close to the city of Torbat Haydariyeh, which is a city near Mashhad, Khorasan province, Iran. Ever since Shahid Boronsi was a child, he had the spirit of antagonizing disbelief and rebellion. For instance, when he was in fourth grade, owing to the inappropriate behavior of one of the anti-Islamic teachers and the unsuitable atmosphere of his school, he left school.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program, The Teacher. Shahid Boronsi was very active politically and culturally during the movement of Imam Khomeini, which led to the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Shahid Boronsi got married in 1969 into a religious and clerical family, and this was another beginning for his persistent fight against the despotic regime of the Shah. As the struggle against the regime of the Shah reached its climax, Shahid Boronsi had to move to Mashhad along with his family. Shahid Boronsi began working as a builder in Mashhad. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Shahid Boronsi entered the SWAT team of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And now, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei talks about Shahid Boronsi.
Khoda inshallah rahmat kone shahid azizemun marhum shahid Boronsi ro hamdur ke arz kardim Ustad Hussein Boronsi.
May Allah bless the soul of Shahid Abdul Hussein Boronsi. Shahid Bransi was neither a doctor nor a professor, but a simple bricklayer who was called Ustad Abdul Hussein, meaning the master bricklayer. However, he had such a deep understanding of the situation in Iran before the Islamic Revolution, and thus he was very much active in the struggles against the Pahlavi regime. After the Islamic Revolution of Iran, he entered the battlefields of the imposed Iraqi war on Iran. Now we know that during the 8-year sacred defense era of Iran, no one entered the battlefields as a commander. All were simple soldiers who, based upon their intelligence and sincerity, could reach higher ranks, such as a general or a commander.
یک نفری وارد میشد بسیجی معمولی بود بعد میدیدن آدم قابلی است میشد فرمانده گروهان یا فرمانده دسته بعد میشد فرمانده گردان بعد میشد فرمانده تیپ میرفت بالا
And now, Shahid Abbas al-Musawi talks about the status of the martyrs.
شهداؤنا تاريخنا شهداؤنا كل أمجادنا شهداؤنا هم قرآننا الناطق.
Our martyrs are the makers of history. Our martyrs are a glory. Our martyrs are the spoken words of Quran. Our martyrs are the sons of Imam al-Hussein, who are the way Imam al-Hussein willed them to be. Our martyrs are Habib ibn Malahir. Our martyrs are Zuhair ibn Ghain. This is who the martyrs of our time are. Look at the way they look at you. They see us, but we don't see them. Through their souls, they are looking at their mothers, fathers, and at us all in a transparent manner. But as for us, the delusions of the materialistic world and our attachment to it, to our dismay, we are unable to see them.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program, The Teacher. During the Iran-Iraq War, Shahid Bransi was not one of those proud commanders who would order his subordinates what to do. In fact, he was very humble and would even wash the dishes behind the fronts. One of the fellow combatants of Shahid Bransi says that while he was washing the dishes, he would go to and fro doing other tasks related to his commandership, such as reconnaissance, deploying troops and dismissing them, and so on and so forth. However, Shahid Bransi would not give the task of washing the dishes and distributing food among soldiers to someone else. Someone came and started washing the dishes instead of him. But Shahid Bransi, with so much compassion, patted him on the back and said, "Thank you for bringing the dishes to the sink. Now let me do the rest of the work." That person insisted, but Shahid Bransi refused and said that he would do the job himself.
Thank you.
And now, Sister Zainab reads to us an excerpt of the last will of today's Shaheed.
The Prophet of Guidance, peace be upon him, and his holy progeny said, "The life of the world is like dipping your finger in the sea and bringing it out. How much water have you taken from the sea? Have you recognized how much of the seawater you have taken? You must pay attention to the fact that the world is like this compared to the hereafter. Man must understand how great the world of the hereafter is, and the blessings that are there for those who follow the path of the prophets. No one can describe them with the tongue and with words. These few days of the world is not worth your going astray and exerting useless effort for material means. My children, I instruct you to pray the same way that Luqman instructed his son. Establish prayer, enjoin the good and forbid evil."
Thank you so much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of The Teacher, which was about Shaheed Boronsi. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com and click on the link, The Call of Islam, to listen to this program as well as our other programs. Until next time, we leave you in Allah's care.
Uniform of a soldier. Part 2.
On the last day of the summer of 1980, on September the 22nd at 10 a.m., a report was received from Gilan-e-Gharb, a provincial city located in the western border of Iran, about the bombing of Iranian territory by the regime of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. In the very early hours of the attack, it was not clear what had happened and what the exact scope of the attack was. At 1:30 p.m., reports of bombing reached Tehran from the western province of Ilam and the city of Dehloram. 15 minutes later, Ahwaz reported